Welcome back to Spanning the State. I'm Brian Noonan. Kristen will be back with us tomorrow. Have you noticed a significant decrease in people practicing good manners? I know it sounds like I'm a cranky old man when I say, yes, I definitely have. And I would imagine you have, too. So I'm reading the paper this morning, as I am wont to do, and there was a column by James Causey in the Journal Sentinel, and he talked about being out on his front porch and watching a guy walking his dog and let his dog take care of business right on James's neighbor's front lawn. Not try to pick it up, nothing. And so James, of course, says he offered this man a bag, and the guy just grumbled and walked away. So that got James thinking about manners, and it got me thinking about manners, too. And we hear all these different stories, whether it's in the news or on social media, and it's just people being very ill-mannered and running around doing whatever they want. So I was thinking about manners, and I was thinking about what may have happened to them, and I'm sure I'm not the only one who, as I go through life, is just confounded by, listen, by no means am I a perfect individual. I don't fancy myself that. I don't pretend to be that. But I do kind of operate with good manners. I say please and thank you. I try to, I still call people Mr. and Mrs., even if they're younger than me, or even if I've known them my entire life, until somebody insists, hey, don't call me Mr. or Mrs. Call me, you know, some of my mom's friends who, you know, a guy of my age calling a person in their 80s Mr. and Mrs., it's a little weird, but I do it until I'm told not to because it's just a sign of respect. So what are some of the manners that you think have gone away? And I have a bold idea. Rhea, stay with me on this. I don't know how many of you are old enough to remember Miss Manners and etiquette classes, whether it be in school or sometimes after. And I know a lot of times those are thought of as the harbor for the well-heeled and the snobby. Oh, they would take an etiquette class. But my freshman year in college, like the housing area had little workshop deals, and one of them was an etiquette class. And you could go, and it was our dorm, which was all guys, and an all-female dorm. So it's like, oh, there's going to be girls there. I'll go learn which fork I should use if I get to talk to some ladies, which paid off in the women's bracket. See, I bring it all back to the beginning of the show. But, so it's nice to know, because while I am, quite frankly, much more comfortable in a dive bar where there isn't a lot of etiquette other than please and thank you and standing up to offer a woman my seat than I am at a black tie affair sitting at a table with a million pieces of silverware in front of me. It's nice to know when I do sit down in front of that silverware that I know how to use it. So I don't know if it would be an elective. I don't know what it should be, and I know the challenges of this proposal, because we're already trying to figure out how to teach kids math and reading. So how are we going to do an etiquette class? I don't know. Maybe you do it after school. Maybe one of the teachers does it for a small stipend. I don't know, but somewhere it needs to be taught, because there's a lot of adults who I wouldn't trust to teach etiquette to a child. Just because I've seen people in public. This is very interesting. UCLA, which is a, you know, pretty reputable university, they just did a study, and their sociologists have found a significant decline in the use of the word please among adults. Do people not say please anymore?
I don't know. I feel like I say please and thank you and sorry a lot.
Yeah. I know I say please and thank you.
Yeah.
I think. Well, according to this, the survey, which happened last year, only 7% of people incorporated into their requests. So, let's say I sent you, I'm trying to think.
No, on the email today, no.
No, please.
No, what's an email, though? So it's not in person.
That's true. Yeah, but I still should, even in the email, can you please pull these?
Yeah,
should say
I knew
that.
What you needed.
All right, thank you. Well, the UCLA found that people say please much less often than expected when they and mostly when they expect a no response. So I knew you were going to do it. So,
all right.
You know, so I guess I didn't feel the need to say please, which I should have done. I apologize for that. People use please when making requests to friends and coworkers. Ooh. Oh, especially when they think the other person might not want to help. So I'm see, then it's disingenuous, because then I'm only saying it to, like, butter you up. If I think, oh, Rhea's not going to do this, I better put on my best manner hat and say, oh, would you please, if I ask real nice, pretty please, with sugar on top? That seems more disingenuous to me.
I mean, that sounds, I would still do it. It's my job. I would do it anyways.
I got to do it. I don't care what you say. I just I'll do it. Leave me alone after that. Just send me the email and leave me alone. So that I found odd. But the study also revealed that manners have deteriorated. That's why some people are tossing trash out. That infuriates me. If I'm behind a car and all of a sudden their McDonald's bag comes out.
Oh, yeah, I can't
and lands
stand
on
that.
The street. I judge you harshly. And let me be, as a dog owner who has owned dogs for over 30 years, if you don't pick up after your dogs, you better hope I don't know where you live, because I'm not going to do anything to you, but I might re-gift your dog's gift.
You've been said to do that before.
Yes, you can, you know, leave it on someone, leave it on their porch or back on their lawn.
That's crazy.
Well, it's theirs.
That's true.
You know, here is the etiquette question that has garnered me a lot of upsetment over the years. I always pick up after my dogs. But if I'm walking around, and especially my dogs get very excited at the beginning of the walk, so their business tends to take place very early in our sojourn. I tie up the bag, and all the garbage cans in our neighborhood are in the alley. And I just toss it in a garbage can. Bagged up, sealed up. People find that unbelievably repugnant. People tell me I'm an animal for doing it.
It's just weird. I mean, I get it, because then it's gone and it's not in the trash. And we talked about this earlier, that it's...
What's weirder, though? Me carrying it around for a half hour in a bag like I'm going to play hacky sack with it?
Well, yes and no, because if it's not your trash... I feel like trash is like one of the most personal things someone has that you don't really realize. So, like, I don't want someone digging around in my trash.
Well, I want to clarify. I'm not opening the can, checking it out, and going, what do they got in there? I'm opening the can and flipping that little bag in, floop, and then I'm on my way.
So, like, if you come home, like, if I come home and, like, oh, if there's dog poop in my trash, I'm going to be a little annoyed. Like, whose
dog
poop is this?
How would you know? I mean, it's in a bag. I mean, obviously, you can kind of tell.
You can smell it.
It's garbage. See, this is where things get me crazy, because it's garbage. It inherently smells. And especially in the summer. What's the difference if I throw a couple ounces of doggy poop in there as opposed to all the other maggot-filled trash you got percolating in that garbage can?
Have you ever had to go back in your trash to go grab something, though? That's what would irk my nerves. If I went back in my trash, like, oh, I forgot this paper, I lost something, then there's someone's dog poop in there?
It's in a bag. I'm not asking you to pick up, a soft handful.
This is true.
It's in a bag. All right, so that's one that we'll debate forever. Another, I remember when swearing in public was frowned upon. And even me, a guy who works in profanity like an artisan, I would not swear in certain places just because it was base. But now people do it all the time. They yell at teachers. That was unheard of. I don't know. What can we do? Oh, here come the texts. Put your poop in your own garbage. One, it's not my poop. So I'm not defiling your can personally. All right, let's do this. That'll be time for the news. All right, one of the texters said, one manner that I think is kind of gone by the wayside is opening doors for your wife, like the car door. That's Rick from Norway. Rhea, you haven't had people open the car door for you?
I haven't had it happen so long that my friend did it for me. We're on vacation. I almost yelled at him to get in the car. And he's like, I'm holding the door open for you. I was like, I'm so sorry.
I'm trying to be chivalrous. Chivalry has no place here. What does have a place here is talking about one fair wage. But first, it's ABC News and local headlines on WTMJ.
Under federal law, workers can be classified as tipped workers if they receive just $30 a month in tips. And that distinction really matters. Because in most states, employers can legally pay tipped workers a much lower base wage, as these cartoon graphics will explain.
Here's how it works. The federal minimum wage is $7.25 per hour, but if you're a tipped worker, it's $2.13 per hour, also referred to as the sub-minimum wage.
Now, that was a term I had not heard of before I watched this episode of Last Week Tonight with John Oliver a couple weeks ago. They went on to talk about One Fair Wage, a group that is working hard for people who've worked for tips. Now, the administration has proposed doing away with taxes on tips. It's now being considered in Congress. But is that going to make a difference to workers? Because consider that poverty rates for tip workers are over 2.3 times as high as poverty rates for non-tipped workers, and more than a third of tipped workers had incomes low enough that they faced no federal income tax at all. So last week tonight with John Oliver exposed how the subminimum wage system exploits tipped workers, keeping them in poverty. So I wanted to find out more about it. I've got Saru Jeyaraj, the president of One Fair Wage, with us. Saru, thanks for being here. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
So explain to folks who I had not heard of One Fair Wage until this Last Week Tonight episode. What's the mission of One Fair Wage?
Yeah, we're about 300,000 restaurant and service workers across the country, including a couple thousand in Wisconsin, and over 1,000 restaurant owners, including several in Wisconsin, that work together to raise wages generally and especially to end the sub-minimum wage for tipped workers, which is a direct legacy of slavery and is still a whopping $2.33 in the great state of Wisconsin.
All right, let's talk about that, with the origins of sub-minimum wage. How is it tied, as you said, to slavery, and what's the impact of it today?
Yeah, so prior to emancipation, waiters in the United States got wages. But tipping was not prevalent at the time. Tipping actually started in Europe as an extra or bonus that aristocrats would give to servants, but always on top of a wage. Servants, even in feudal Europe, got actual full wages or salaries. Tips were always a bonus on top of that. It wasn't until after emancipation that the restaurant industry in the United States wanted the ability to hire newly freed black people, black women in particular, and continue to not pay them, even though slavery had ended. And so they came up with this idea of telling workers, we're not going to pay you. You're going to live entirely on this new thing that's come from Europe called a tip. And that is the origin of workers getting nothing or next to nothing and having to live on tips. That was never the way tips were intended to be anywhere in the world. It was a uniquely American phenomenon post-emancipation that was meant to allow restaurants the ability to hire black people for free.
So if we've still got states, and Wisconsin, as you mentioned, is one of them that still has that sub-minimum wage, if this, you know, it's an easy cheering point to hear, oh, no tax on tips, that's great, we want our tipped workers not to pay taxes. In reality, would it make any difference?
Very little. I mean, tipped workers from 1865 until today have always been mostly women working in really casual restaurants and bars across every state, including Wisconsin. They struggle with 3 times the poverty rate, as you mentioned, of other workers. They use food stamps at double the rate of other workers. Lots of single moms working as servers and bartenders, struggling to make ends meet, struggling with the highest rates of sexual harassment of any industry because they have to put up with so much from customers to get tips. And so our research shows two-thirds of tipped workers in America aren't even eligible, don't even earn enough to pay federal income tax. And so it's only going to matter to a small minority of workers who make a lot of money in tips, and good for them. But for the overwhelming majority of tipped workers, what they want, what they've been asking for decades, is a full livable minimum wage with their tips on top of that. Look, that is what happens right now in your neighboring state of Minnesota. Minnesota is one of 7 states that requires a full minimum wage with tips on top, and they have for decades. And the 7 states that have done this, including California and Oregon and Washington, Nevada, Minnesota, Montana, and Alaska, all have higher restaurant sales per capita than Wisconsin, higher job growth in the restaurant industry than Wisconsin, higher small business growth rates, and higher tipping. And that is because when these workers are paid well, guess what they do? They eat out more. And they tip better because they know what it's like to live on tips. And so jobs are doing better in those states and tipping is higher.
Well, I know that is are the statistics. So what do you say then to the people? Because the other argument is, and it doesn't really bear out based on what you just said, but if a state does away with subminimum wage and the tipping is just either on top or in addition to a regular minimum wage, that people are going to say, well, I don't have to tip because they're already making their money. That doesn't hold water, does it?
It doesn't. I mean, I'm sure many of your listeners have been to some of these states. You've been to Minnesota, sure. You've been to California, you've been to Chicago, which passed this a few years ago. I mean, I'm sure your listeners didn't even know that those states did it differently and didn't tip differently. Even in Wisconsin, we are in touch with great restaurants in Wisconsin that are already paying a full minimum wage. I'm sure nobody knows who they are and doesn't think right. to pay any differently. The truth is, people don't tip based on how much people earn. I'm sure, have you ever walked into a restaurant and asked somebody how much they earn before you decide how much to tip? You just don't.
No, tip never
on
once.
That basis.
Right.
Yeah.
You tip on service. That's what you tip on, service and
that's
the,
right.
the quality
that's
of
right.
your experience. Now,
right.
what about the other argument is, all right, well, what is this going to do to the restaurant owners who are already operating on slim margins in a lot of cases? How will that affect them? And that, I know, is one of the things that people bring up all the time when they're trying to argue against the minimum wage
right.
for tipped workers.
That's right. Well, our data shows, it's actually government data, it's not our data, that small business restaurants grow faster in Minnesota and California and the seven states that have done this, and Chicago even. And it's because, again, when restaurant workers are paid more, they eat out more. They actually eat out more than other people because they're in the industry. And they support the very businesses that, you know, are being asked to pay more. So paying people more is a virtuous cycle. Paying people more puts money in working people's pockets. Working people spend more in the economy than wealthy people. And so the business does better. And you don't have to take it from me. In fact, even the chains, Denny's and IHOP, in 2021, when this is being considered in Congress by Biden, actually, they told their shareholders in 2021, we're going to be just fine because our businesses are growing faster in California than any other state because we pay our people 15-plus tips. And guess what happens? They bring their families to eat in our restaurants, and our guest receipts are higher.
It makes sense. Now, One Fair Wage has made the claim that the National Restaurant Association uses misinformation to keep the wages low. Can you explain that and how that works?
Yeah. So in 2016, when Donald Trump was first elected president, his communications firm was called Mercury PR. The National Restaurant Association hired that firm because they were so impressed with Donald Trump's success that they hired that firm and started what they call an AstroTurf pack, a fake grassroots, essentially, called Save Our Tips, to go around and tell workers that their tips would go away if their wages go up, and that all the things you just said, businesses would fail. They've been fear-mongering for decades, okay. when in fact they have admitted themselves, the National Restaurant Association, that doing this serves them better in the states that have already done it. So it's a lot of misinformation. It's a lot of fear. But the truth is that when you pay people better, they can afford to live. They support the economy. They support the business. And the business does better.
And, Saru, before I let you go, what's the 25 by 250 campaign that One Fair Wage is working on?
Yeah, well, I think the election results from 2024 were very clear. People, most Americans are concerned with the cost of living, and that is why we are winning this issue in cities and states across the country. Workers need to be paid enough to feed their families. So we've got bills and ballot measures moving in 25 states, half the country, to raise the wage to a full livable wage with tips on top, and we're winning it state by state.
All right, very nice. Well, I appreciate the time, and I'm sure, how did you guys react when you heard that John Oliver was including you in the big piece?
Yeah, so we actually provided them with a ton of research and information and data. We were extremely excited that he had uplifted this. He had previously done a piece focused on this astroturfing, these corporate-funded misinformation campaigns, and uplifted the Save Our Tips campaign. So he's on it.
Yeah.
And people should listen.
Well, I hope they do it. I hope they're listening now. Saru Jayaraman is the president of One Fair Wage. I appreciate your time today, Saru.
Thank you. Appreciate you.
Talk to you later. All right, let's do this. Then, speaking of people who work in the food industry or just food, if you're heading to AmFam Field this season for a Brewers game, some tasty new treats. Let's see what they are after this on Spanning the State. All right. Finally, we get the old man music in here. A little walk this way. Yeah. Oh, you tell me this run DMC?
No, it's Aerosmith. I had old man music for most of the show today.
Did you? I wasn't paying attention. Listen, I'm focusing on the show. I don't have time. Now I'm in a, you know, I'm seeing the finish line. I'm going to be talking about food at the ballpark. Spring is in the air. Today's the last spring training game. Of course, this Thursday is opening day. The Brewers will be in New York taking on the Yankees. And then next Monday, it's opening day at AmFam Field. And, man, oh man, we're going to be doing all kinds of things here on WTMJ. So you want to be around for opening day. But, I will admit to being a purist when I go to a ball game as far as food. I want a hot dog, I want a beer, and I want some peanuts. Now, occasionally, if I'm feeling saucy, I will get myself a soft pretzel. So those are my go-tos. There's always so many things, though, to choose from, and every year the Brewers and AmFam Field add new things that make... that pull me out of my purist standpoint and make me say, all right, well, I got to have a brat. Oh, look at an old-fashioned. Sure, an old-fashioned at the ballpark. That's fun. So they've added some new food this year around the ballpark and in Maxie's club level. So here's some of the new food, and they sound – I like when a ballpark adds some new stuff. And as I'm looking at this, none of these dishes fit what I'm about to say. But some places, when they try to be too fancy, this won't surprise you, but in the Chavez Ravine, Dodger Stadium, they have sushi. That seems a little, you know, but that's, you know, you play to your demographic. Anyway, here, chicken cordon bleu. It's a fried chicken breast, shaved ham, Swiss cheese, beer, butter, onions, and brown mustard on a potato bun. That sounds all right, except the ham. Maxie's Spicy Southern, another chicken. Chicken sandwiches have become, I think they've taken over. Can we agree the chicken sandwiches are now the top sandwich when you go anywhere? Zesty hot sauce, pickles, and comeback sauce on a potato bun. There's an enchilada dog, which is a corn tortilla with melted cheese, sour cream, onion, and cilantro. A bases loaded potato dog. See, right, that all sounds good, but imagine now trying to walk down the aisle. You're carrying this, then you're in your little seat, and you've got your beverage either between your feet or on the little cup holder on the back of the seat, and you're trying to eat a bases loaded potato dog, which is topped with cheddar cheese, bacon, sour cream, tater tots, and green onions.
Okay, that one sounds better than the enchilada one.
You don't like the enchilada dog with...
It's too much going on.
Salsa roja, melted cheese, sour cream, onion, and cilantro?
Too much for me. But I will say, when we have a baseball game, I just want to do a straight hot dog.
That's it. When I go to like a hot dog stand, I get mustard, relish, onion, peppers on my hot dog. I love a plain hot dog out of that tin box that one of the vendors is walking around with.
Yeah.
To me, that is the best hot dog.
Tinfoil? Mm-hmm.
Yes, and I feel like a child. They go, you want a mustard pack? No, not here at the ballpark. I just want to house a couple of these plain hot dogs.
What do you put on your hot dogs?
On a regular basis, mustard, relish, onion, and sport peppers.
Sport peppers?
There's a little red, little green, really hot peppers.
Oh, like you get on like a Chicago dog?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, yum.
But not at the ballpark. I don't want all those condiments dropping on me.
No?
No.
Oh.
I don't know what it is. I don't know why I like the flavor of a plain hot dog at the ballpark, but
it's
I
gotta
do.
It's got to be that, man.
I love it. They also have a hurricane cocktail at Maxie's and chicken and andouille jambalaya in case you're feeling like you want to be in the Big Easy when it's, you know, 100 degrees in July and you're sitting in the outfield sun. Enjoy that. Let's do this. Then there's more. It's Spanning the State. I believe it's time for me to fly. All right, that's it for today. Kristen will be back with us tomorrow. Another big show. Hope you will join us. Wisconsin's afternoon news is next, right after the regular news. See ya.